Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, September 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto. From the front page of today's Gazette, Tama County faces long road back to normal, weeks after the derecho federal relief starts to flow, by Gage Missikemen, the Gazette, in Vining. After last month's derecho blew through, this small town faced a big problem. The town looks like a war zone, recalled Steve Rouse, mayor of the community of 47 people east of Tama. We don't have a budget. We're such a small town. We had folks come in and give us a quote of $400,000 for cleanup that you have to pay up front. We don't have that kind of money to begin with. Many homes in town received at least some damage. One trailer home was destroyed. Perhaps half the trees in town were lost. Rouse's father, Red Rouse, who also serves on the Vining City Council, got on the phone. He reached out to State Senator Jeff Edler, our state senator, for help. Soon, the Iowa Department of Transportation got involved in helping move a large pile of debris that was forming in the middle of town to the county landfill, free of charge. My dad really took the bull by the horns and started making phone calls, Mayor Rouse said. Edler made it happen for us and got the DOT out here. There were 100 loads they hauled out. It was relentless, Red Rouse said of the August 10th storm. When it was done, I took a ride around town and it was devastating. We had roads blocked, trees, posts everywhere. Half of our street signs were gone. Steve Rouse said the town was without power for 9 days, but everyone started dragging their debris to the pile in the center of town. It's an elderly town, the mayor said. The majority of people here are 50 plus and everybody did a good job helping neighbors clean up. It's pretty amazing what a small town can do with no budget and elbow grease. It has been over a month since the hurricane force derecho ripped through Iowa, tearing a path from Des Moines to Cedar Rapids. In the midst of the storm's path sits Tama County, ranked only in the middle of Iowa's county populations, though it lies between the state's two largest cities. Every community in the county felt the derecho's wrath. Buildings and grain silos were destroyed. Tree canopies will take decades or longer to recover. Mindy Benson, Emergency Management Coordinator for Tama County, said she may never have official numbers for how many buildings in the county were affected. For just Tama County, we sustained a heavy amount of damage to all our county infrastructure in the Tama-Toledo area, Benson said. The chimney fell off the courthouse, putting holes in the roof. A secondary road shop and main garage was destroyed. Half of the garage blew off while mechanics were inside of it. The entirety of the county was among thousands of customers without power following the storm. But like many communities in eastern Iowa, the first priority was making sure residents were safe. We had to get access to the streets, Benson said. Making sure no one is touching electrical lines, making sure those streets got cleared. We got those pushed off the road so we could get emergency response vehicles around. On September 1st, 3 weeks after the storm hit, Tama County was approved for the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Individual Assistance Program, enabling property owners and renters to seek aid for some things not covered by insurance. On September 11th, a month after the storm, the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi and Iowa, located within Tama County, got its own presidential disaster declaration from President Donald Trump. Meskwaki Nation Executive Director Lawrence Spotted Bird said FEMA aid is being coordinated with the state disaster declaration for Tama County residents. Spotted Bird said about 200 of the 350 homes on the settlement were damaged after the storm, which temporarily displaced some 600 people. Meskwaki Nation was able to get the displaced residents into a hotel until they were able to return home. The most pressing cleanup has been completed, he said, and the focus has shifted to repairing damage. The emergency part is done, he said. We're forming an emergency plan that was being developed before the derecho, but we weren't quite there. We want to have a plan in place, planning for the next disaster. We want to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. Meskwaki Nation has received help from other tribes around the country, as well as various groups and individuals. We received a lot of support from different nonprofits. They had equipment we could not get. There was nothing available at the time, Spotted Bird said. We're getting calls from different individuals wanting to help. We got a financial donation from another tribe in California. With the emergency over, Meskwaki Nation and the rest of Tama County faces a long road ahead to recover. Contractors are really hard to come by in the area to get things fixed, said Benson, the emergency management coordinator. We still see tarps on roof, plywood on windows, tree debris on curbs. It's a slow process and city workers are doing the rounds, but it takes a lot to get it all done. The tree pile at the landfill is growing exponentially by the day. In Tama, Mayor Doug Ray said the city was in its last week of picking up tree debris. "We have a lot of houses that still have roof damage," Ray said. "It's come along good. A lot of people stepped up." Ray, who is in his first mayoral term after 8 years on the Tama City Council, said he hopes to never see another derecho like this one. "I've been in Tama for 55 years, and I've never seen nothing like it, and I hope I never do," he said. Following the storm, Tama was without power in some areas for up to 2 weeks. Ray said he spent the first couple of days afterward in a loader moving trees off the roads. When Tama County was added to the disaster proclamation and approved for FEMA aid, Ray said that took some of the burden off for the community. The cities of Tama and Toledo covered any landfill fees for residents, too, as they got rid of debris. "That saved a lot for people," he said, "but we're headed in the right direction, and it will all come back to normal someday between this and COVID." Catherine Olendike, director of Tama County Economic Development, said there's not a fully accurate count of businesses affected by the derecho because the damage was so extreme. "It's going to take us a while just to get cleaned up," she said. "Tama and Toledo were greatly affected. That's where most of our businesses are concentrated because that's where most of the population is. I worry about towns like Vining, Elberon, and Chelsea," she added. "Their budgets are on the absolute brink right now. There's money to pay the bills for the city every year, but the extra expenses can be overwhelming." Olendike said the recovery for those living in rural areas on farms could take years. "Some farmers are looking at 2-3 years to get their grain bins built," she said. "The outside world looks at us and thinks, oh, they cleaned up trees and everything's back up. The effects of the derecho are long-term." Also from the front page of today's Gazette, CR Mayor takes heat following derecho. Hart acknowledges misstep but presses for more aid, by Aaron Jordan and Marissa Payne of the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. Even without power or internet, dozens of frustrated Cedar Rapids residents found ways to email Mayor Brad Hart in the days after the August 10th derecho to complain about his response. "Why has the guard not been called in? Are you on the phone to Washington every hour asking our state representatives to send help? You should be. What is the matter with you?" Hart admits his saying in an August 13th KCRG TV9 interview that city staff didn't think Cedar Rapids needed help from the National Guard wasn't really accurate, and says he's a slow learner when it comes to speaking carefully. But the lawyer, who's 3 years into his first term in public office, says he's tried every day to work for the city's recovery from the storm by doing things like talking with MSNBC's Chuck Todd about destruction in Cedar Rapids, pressing President Donald Trump to approve individual assistance for storm victims, and responding to many angry constituent emails, although not always without irritation himself. The Gazette reviewed hundreds of emails to and from Hart, City Manager Jeff Pomerantz, and Fire Chief Greg Smith from the week after the August 10th derecho, in which winds of up to 140 miles per hour whipped the city for 45 minutes to see how the city leaders stood up in the eye of the storm. Natural disaster response can make or break politicians. Just ask former President George W. Bush, who took the lion's share of the blame for shortcomings in the response to Hurricane Katrina in 2005, said Tim Hagel, an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. "If it comes on you and you're not prepared, things can go south on you very badly," Hagel said. President Bush got a lot of the blame for it, but it was really the local folks who weren't prepared. Research shows people who are engaged in local politics are more likely to rebuke local, county, or state officials for problems after a natural disaster, said Megan Goldberg, an assistant professor of American politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. People who are less engaged in local politics blame the president. After New Orleans, Bush had a really low opinion rating, but the mayor of New Orleans won another term, Goldberg said. There are obviously things like partisanship that comes into it, but the more you know about local politics, the more you are to attribute blame to your local government. One of the people who emailed Hart to ask about the National Guard was Jessica Shadow, 38, of Cedar Rapids. "Are they, the Guard, going to be called to be deployed to help with the cleanup effort today?" she wrote at 1:40 p.m. August 13th. Later that day, the city confirmed more than 100 Guard members would come to the area to help with tree debris removal, but Shadow said that should have happened sooner. "I still see debris out on our streets, and it's not safe when I'm driving," she told the Gazette. "If they would have contacted the Guard and got more people to help, it wouldn't have taken a month." Hart didn't get back to Shadow by phone or email, she said. The mayor did reply, with some heat, to Vernon Squires, a Cedar Rapids lawyer, who said, "We can do better," in an August 14th email about trees and power lines on Cottage Grove Avenue, still being down 5 days after the storm. "The city is not responsible for the Alliant poles and lines," Hart replied August 15th. "They have 1,000 people here clearing lines and poles. Do you really think we are not doing everything we can to help this city?" In other responses, Hart was more patient. When someone from out of town emailed to ask him to contact the government, federal agencies, and nonprofits to help, Hart replied, "We've done that and mobilized our full team of emergency response. Terrible situation, but we'll recover again because we care about each other. Hart's own home sustained damage in the derecho. A tree tore through his ceiling and hit his wife as she was running through their bedroom to get away from the crashing limbs, he told the Gazette. Contrary to a rumor on social media, Hart did not leave Cedar Rapids during the storm aftermath, he said last week, and he was regularly seen by the media at the city's incident command center at a fire station. Absolutely not true, he said of the rumor. I was at the fire station every damn day. My house is significantly damaged. I suffered through those same issues, but I never left town. City Council member Patrick Loeffler said he initially was shocked to hear Hart say in the television interview that City Manager Jeff Pomeranz didn't think the city needed the National Guard. There's rumors going around on social media that we have refused the National Guard help. I would like clarification myself, he wrote in an August 14th email to Hart. Pomeranz and other city council members after council member Martin Hoger raised some questions through email the day before. Pomeranz wrote to the group at 11:03 p.m. August 13th. I was surprised too, he said. There have been many discussions, but those were not my words at all. Hart responded August 14th, saying he was misquoted and never said we refused National Guard help. He later said he had been speaking strictly about tree debris removal, which was already well underway with city crews, Iowa Department of Transportation teams, and private contractors. The portion of the KCRG TV interview posted online starts midway, so the listener doesn't know what Hart and the interviewer were talking about before the National Guard comment came up. But in the interview, Hart did say, I don't know that we need help. Hart apologized for the comment during the August 25th City Council meeting, saying, in fact, Pomeranz did request the National Guard. Hart said Wednesday his statement to KCRG TV was probably not a great assessment. The debris was even worse than anyone had anticipated. Loeffler told the Gazette last week that Hart's explanation makes sense and that he believed the mayor and other council members were doing all they could in the aftermath. I'm very proud of the way the city and Brad responded after that, he said. Daily activity logs maintained by Chief Smith in the aftermath of the storm and made public through the Gazette's open records request don't mention the National Guard until August 14th, the day 100 engineers began to work here. But Smith told the Gazette on Friday the Guard was part of the city officials' discussions at various points that week. As early as August 11th, the day after the storm, Smith verbally asked Linn County Emergency Management Coordinator Steve Okonek about requesting the National Guard, he said. The Guard also was a discussion point at a meeting with city leaders August 13th, hours before news broke that 100 engineers were on their way. Cities can identify their needs and relay those to the County Emergency Management Agency, which deploys resources to meet those needs or works with other entities to fulfill a request, Smith said. But municipalities cannot specifically request a resource like the National Guard, he said. The National Guard blocked streets for Alliant Energy crews to work, helping city public works crews focus on clearing city streets of tree debris. The Guard engineers' trucks are smaller than the city and Iowa Department of Transportation trucks, so Smith said their power restoration mission was a perfect fit for Cedar Rapids' needs. That's where the two kind of became married, of what they need to do and what we needed, and that was the marriage that we needed at that point, Smith said. When Trump touched down briefly August 18th in Cedar Rapids to hear briefings about the storm from local officials, many of those officials spent much of their time thanking the president for approving on August 17th about $45 million in public assistance, including money for debris removal and repair to government buildings and utilities. But at that event, Hart told Trump that Cedar Rapidians needed more. One of the things that's in the disaster declaration is the individual assistance because so many people have homeowners insurance, but there's still a premium, Hart said. He added that insurance doesn't cover spoiled food or removing down trees from properties. Adding the individual assistance component to the disaster proclamation would really help so many people get those trees out of the yard and not have such a financial burden, Hart told the president. He also handed Trump a letter that talked about how state disaster assistance grants were available only to help low-income residents, but the federal disaster funds could help more of the tens of thousands of residents affected by the derecho. Hart said he was glad to make the pointed request and even more glad when Trump approved it August 20th. That was something that was really important for our community and will continue to be important, he said last week. I'm happy to have the opportunity to ask the president personally for that. Highlights from the Iowa Today flood control system grows in Cedar Rapids with a start Monday. Five projects ongoing this year by Marissa Payne of the Gazette. A disruptive pandemic and destructive derecho haven't put a stop to the work on five projects building towards Cedar Rapids' $750 million flood control system. Work on the projects, a new facility providing restrooms and event storage at the McGrath Amphitheater, a giant rolling gate across 16th Avenue Southeast, a stackable gate downtown, a stretch of levee in Newbow, and a flood wall guarding Quaker Oats will carry construction crews into the beginning of 2021. The city's budget calls for spending $45.6 million on flood protection in fiscal 2021, which ends June 30th, a boost of $7.7 million over fiscal 2020. That investment adds to the $93 million the city has spent on flood control since 2014. As of March 31st, the Army Corps of Engineers has spent $15 million of its total cost share portion of $76.4 million after federal aid finally was approved in 2018, a decade after a historic flood inundated some 10 square miles of the city. The federal money applies only to approved sections of the $250 million east side system, not the west side of the river. And here are the projects underway. Lot 44 levee in New Bohemia. The levee will stretch from approximately 9th Avenue Southeast to 12th Avenue Southeast. The levee is scheduled for completion in spring 2021. Amphitheater flood wall. The facility includes a built-in flood wall to the 2008 flood volume and includes a public restroom and storage for events. The facility is scheduled for completion in spring 2021. 16th Avenue Southeast floodgate. The floodgate will roll across the road, protecting the community and neighborhood to the 2008 flood volume. The gate is scheduled for completion in fall 2020. Quaker Oats flood wall. Construction of the 2,000-foot flood wall and pump station will be completed in spring 2021, with the final phase completing the railroad closure gate at the Cedar River in fall 2021. 3rd Avenue Southeast removable floodgates. Work scheduled to start Monday and be complete in spring or summer 2021. 3rd Avenue Southeast will be closed during construction. Also from the Gazette today, student athletes strive to register more voters at UI by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. With just 6 weeks until the general election, University of Iowa sports teams are using some of their star power to get more students registered to vote. Megan Conroy, a junior field hockey player from Chesterfield, Missouri, is one of the student athletes leading the Get Out the Vote effort among the Iowa Student Athlete Advisory Committee, of which she is treasurer secretary. She recently answered questions from the Gazette about the project. Question: what are your goals for voter registration in UI athletics? Answer: the first thing we're really pushing is the 90% challenge. It was brought to us by Hawk the Vote, which is another group on campus. It's a campus-wide campaign that encourages all student organizations at the University of Iowa to become more civically engaged. They are trying to push each group to have 90% of their members be registered to vote. We want, as our group of ISAAC, to have 100%. We think we can do it. Question: how are you promoting voter registration with so many campus events being virtual? Answer: the biggest thing right now is social media. I see it all over my Instagram and Twitter, using student athletes as a platform to get the word out. Question: why are you motivated to vote? Answer: this will be my first time voting, so it's kind of exciting. At the Big Ten Voting Challenge Task Force meeting, it was about 50-50 first-time voters and those who had voted before. Growing up, my parents always encouraged us. It's our civic duty, our right to vote. With the different situations going on in America, the importance of voting is more apparent now. Question: Iowa has had some soul-searching moments in the past months related to Black Lives Matter, which, of course, has been a national movement. Do these issues motivate student-athletes to vote? Answer: for sure. My meeting with my team was about diversity, equity, and inclusion. As a team, we're making an action plan and goals. Everything nationally going on is definitely pushing people to vote. We have the ability to make a change, and now's the time. Question: what information are you sharing with students to help them register? Answer: if I wasn't a student athlete, I don't know if information would have gotten to me. It really is simple. To register, you just go online to vote.org. There are so many campus resources I don't think a lot of students know about. For me, I'm going to be registered in Missouri. Hawk the Vote told me I need to order my ballot. Question: is how and where to vote part of the equation? Answer: September is getting people registered. October and November will be more about pushing the details. They're going to bring back alumni and other athletes to talk about why we vote. For current students, it will make a huge impact hearing from their role models, the people who created the history here. From the Iowa Today page, columnist Liz Lentz writes, Iowa has another health crisis, STIs. In Iowa, we deal with hardship through grit, determination, and passive-aggressive denial. If we don't see it, it didn't happen, which works if you are trying to ignore your high schooler's vape habit, but not if you are handling a public health crisis. Governor Kim Reynolds has repeatedly refused to release key information about the novel coronavirus pandemic, such as accurate numbers on meatpacking plant outbreaks and positive and negative case data exclusively from Test Iowa, the public-private partnership for COVID-19 testing. For months, the state was backdating positive tests, and the state is not tracking outbreaks at K-12 schools. Other key pieces of data are falling through the pandemic loophole, the rates of sexually transmitted infections like gonorrhea and chlamydia. A story in the Daily Iowan, the University of Iowa's college newspaper, quotes Johnson County health officials saying they are not testing for STIs as frequently as they did before, citing a lack of resources due to the pandemic. Johnson County is home to the UI, one of the nation's COVID-19 hotspots. Iowa's STI rates already were on the rise thanks to a 2017 Republican law that effectively gutted Planned Parenthood and made it harder to access reproductive health care in the state. The law forced four Planned Parenthood locations across the state to close. The state then set up its own family planning network. An investigation by the Gazette found that many of the clinics in that network didn't provide family planning services at all. Some were labs, one was a dentist office, another a high school nurse, a homeless shelter, and a dermatologist. Others were religiously affiliated clinics run by activists opposed to abortion rights. Additionally, requiring people to set up appointments and pay out of pocket or use Medicaid added a barrier to accessing health care. Experts at the time warned this could lead to higher STI rates and more abortions. Not surprisingly, now STI rates in Iowa are on the rise, and so are abortions. Boldly marching forward and adopting medically unsound policies is how we ended up with over 1,200 Iowans dead from COVID-19 and leading the nation as one of its worst virus hotspots. It's also how we've effectively caused another health crisis. STIs are skyrocketing in Iowa, said Aaron Davison Rippey, Iowa Executive Director of Planned Parenthood North Central States. Now, public health officials are being taken off combating STIs, which means STIs are only going to get worse. Iowans need access to testing and treatment. There are lasting health impacts. STIs are infections that, left untreated, can cause infertility, stroke, blindness, and a myriad other health problems. The health of Iowans is at stake. A short-sighted solution leaves Iowans behind today and sick tomorrow. When Iowa Department of Human Services Director Kelly Garcia took over on November 1, 2019, she promised to look at the family planning data and issue a report. But a pandemic and the derecho, which was the equivalent of an inland hurricane, have made everything in the state that much harder. Matt Hyland, the public information officer for Human Services, explained, "Staff in the STD program were temporarily reassigned to assist with COVID-19 follow-up. Staff in our bureau are experienced with contact tracing as well as the data management system that the department utilizes to communicate the diseases, for communicable diseases. These team members are well positioned to step in and offer assistance while the state responds to the pandemic. The COVID-19 pandemic has required health departments across the country to reallocate resources to address the pandemic in their jurisdictions." Hyland added that STI testing was driven down by the pandemic. Clinics that did remain open often experienced lower patient volumes because patients were uncomfortable presenting at the clinic due to concerns of COVID-19 spread. More recently, there have been nationwide shortages and backorders of key components to chlamydia gonorrhea testing. This has forced us to prioritize testing for chlamydia gonorrhea further with our safety net STD clinics. Addressing this issue still remains a priority for Director Garcia, but the reality is the department is left to suture the gaping wound that Republicans gave to the state in 2017. When you gut the social safety net, you can't be surprised when people fall through. Meanwhile, in the state, we are not crushing the COVID-19 curve. The curve is crushing us. But don't worry, bars and restaurants and gyms are open. It's governance by closing your eyes and sticking your fingers in your ears and saying, "I can't hear you," until the problem goes away. In fact, it never does. In fact, it's only getting worse. And turning to the Insight page with the letters to the editor and an editorial cartoon by Joe Heller of Green Bay. The editorial cartoon features a neighborhood with three small homes in a row. On the left, we have a man looking out a window wearing a MAGA hat with a sign in his yard that says Trump 2020, chained down. On the right, we have a woman looking out in her yard. She has surveillance cameras on her Biden-Harris sign. And in the middle, there is a couple looking out their window. Their sign is not in any way held down. The woman and the couple says, "I'm not worried someone will steal my yard sign." And their yard sign says, "November 3rd can't come soon enough." The first letter is from Patricia A. Eichen of Solon. Biden will restore dignity to presidency. In 2015, Republican Donald Trump said John McCain, a Vietnam War POW, wasn't a war hero. I was incensed. My uncle, Sam Lyle, was a POW in Germany during World War II. I couldn't believe that any U.S. citizen, regardless of party, would vote for Trump after that outrageous statement. The Atlantic's article of September 3rd reignited my fury. How can a person who disparages military members and service members, our veterans, and the fallen who made the ultimate sacrifice be reelected? I also recalled President Donald Trump's non-response to this summer's reports on Russian bounties being paid to kill American troops in Afghanistan. As a lifelong Democrat who first voted 55 years ago, I asked you to vote for Joe Biden for president. Joe demonstrates compassion and respect for the military. Electing Joe will restore the needed dignity and global leadership to the office of the president. Patricia A. Eichen of Solon. Next, David Zahn of Cedar Rapids writes, "Let the athletes play." There is a battle raging over whether students should be in school or not. The travesty that exists due to online learning is that athletes cannot compete because they are not in the building. Teams were active and now inactive because education is now all online. The athletes are still being educated to an extent. Don't punish the teams by halting their seasons just because they don't pass over the threshold of a building. That was David Zahn of Cedar Rapids. Next, Daryl Siverson of Strawberry Point writes, election will show our character. Character counts and truth matters. The world will find out if that is true November 3rd, and so will your children and grandchildren. Next, from Tom Martin of Iowa City, simple questions voters should ask themselves. Before you vote in the November 3rd election, ask yourself these simple questions. If you discovered your doctor, banker, lawyer, agriculture, chemical, or seed salesman was a pathological liar, wouldn't you fire him or her and get a new one? Of course you would, as would any logical thinking person. So why would anyone vote to rehire a president who, according to the Washington Post, has made over 20,000 false or misleading statements in the last 4 years, which includes, of course, those recently revealed comments regarding the COVID-19 pandemic? As you answer these questions, ask yourself, how have I been impacted by Trump's disastrous handling of this pandemic? Think about it. Tom Martin of Iowa City. Next, Tim Rickle of Cedar Rapids writes, vote on performance, not personality. This is a quote. I believe American people who truly value democracy and their way of life will safeguard this great country by voting. Those people who promote Marxist communist thought know nothing about communism. They even ignore what happened in the real world. That was written by a concerned friend and colleague in communist country citizen told me. That's what a friend told me. November election issues are clearly contrasted. Democrat leaders ignore COVID-19 rules while fueling and financing violence, paralyzing police, abolishing bails, and declining outside help unless it's money. This party will raise taxes, resume job-killing regulations, destroy beneficial trade agreements, tear down border walls, welcome illegals, adopt universal health care, and an unscientific $100 trillion Green New Deal, any or all, which would bankrupt our country. Additionally, killing unborn babies, free religion and speech would result in replacing our republic with a Marxist rule by a few. Republican leaders won't allow anarchists to destroy our cities. They will protect citizens' rights to defend themselves. Despite incessant opposition, this party and president built a strong economy with record employment, enabling us to afford temporary COVID lockdowns and stimulus help. Early executive action greatly limited COVID spread from Asia and Europe. The Republican Party and the president are for lower taxes, limited government, law and order, strong defense, sanctity of life, free enterprise, freedom of speech, religion, and media, the republic for which we stand. Based not on personalities and promises, but values and performance, please vote accordingly. That was Tim Bickle of Cedar Rapids. And Roger Kistler of Olin writes, where is OSHA when it really counts? When I walk into many stores and businesses, I see employees who are required by their employers to wear face masks, but I have never seen any employees wearing an oxygen monitor inside their mask. Where is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, otherwise known as OSHA? They have standards that are supposed to protect our working men and women. The air we breathe consists of 20.9% oxygen. When the oxygen concentration in any confined space falls below 19.5%, OSHA considers this an oxygen-deficient, hazardous atmosphere that can threaten life or health. Certainly, a face mask is a confined space. When we exhale carbon dioxide within the confines of a face mask, we rebreathe some of that carbon dioxide in the next breath. This effectively reduces the percentage of oxygen we inhale. The OSHA website recommends wearing face masks to keep us safe from disease. But is OSHA only telling us half of the story? Are our nation's employees getting enough oxygen? Automobiles we buy are required to have at least 2 oxygen sensors, and depending on the exhaust configuration, as many as 6. Are we more concerned about our cars being short of oxygen than our working men and women? Employers need to start monitoring the percentage of oxygen their employees are breathing inside those masks. That was Roger Kistler of Olin. Quotes of the week. First, we have Greg Hayes, CEO of Collins Aerospace parent company Raytheon Technologies, on plans to lay off thousands of employees while hiring thousands of others. It's a big reduction on the commercial side, strong growth on the defense side. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley praising the Trump administration for upholding key portions of the renewable fuel standard. Senator Grassley says, I applaud President Trump for keeping his word and supporting our farmers and biofuel producers. Tom Vilsack, former Iowa governor and former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, criticizing the long delay in Trump's decision to reject biofuel waivers. Mr. Vilsack says he becomes a Johnny-come-lately to the third promise of supporting the RFS. Michelle Balmer with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources on the impact of animal feeding operations on water quality in lakes. Ms. Balmer says, we have to respect that individual landowners have to make those decisions on their own. Rafa El-Sheikh, a senior at Kennedy High School, on the recent protest movement and the formation of a black student union, Ms. El-Sheikh says, I feel like we're finally being heard. We're finally getting all this stuff we've been fighting for years. Vicky Nauman, a former All-American swimmer at the University of Iowa, on the effort to reinstate swimming and other sports that were recently announced to be terminated, Ms. Nauman said, there's been nothing but really closed doors. And Lisa Radigan, I'm on spokeswoman on the last homes to get internet service restored after the August 10th derecho. Ms. Radigan said, it's more onesies and twosies, so the progress is slower. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, September 20th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. From Cedar Rapids, Richard Taylor, known as Dick, age 89, died Thursday, September 17th, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Cedar Rapids. Jerome Francis Frick, known as Jerry, aged 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Monday, September 14th, in his home surrounded by his loving family. Per the wishes of the family, services will be held at a later date. Cedar Memorial has been entrusted with the arrangements. James Michael Hirsch, 67, of Cedar Rapids, died at Hemp Hill Hospice on September 14th. A private service will be planned. Bernice Oma Carnahan of Marion, age 101, formerly of Marion, currently of Prescott Valley, Arizona, passed away Tuesday, September 15th at Villa Flori Assisted Living in Prescott Valley. In accordance with her wishes, cremation has taken place and a memorial service will be held next summer, 2021. Virginia R. Hammond, age 78, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away Sunday, September 13th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Monday, September 21st at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, Iowa. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a face mask and practice social distancing. Robert Kramer, known as Bob, age 90, of the Keystones Place, died in his sleep on Tuesday, September 15th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Per his wishes, his eyes were donated to the Iowa Organ Donor Network, and his body was donated to the University of Iowa Anatomy Department. The date of a celebration of life is to be determined. Papich Kuba Funeral Service in Cedar Rapids is serving the family. In lieu of flowers, the family has respectfully requested that any memorial contributions be made in Bob Kramer's name to the Cedar Rapids Softball Hall of Fame. Brian Frederick Minnie, 42, of Cedar Rapids, went peacefully to heaven on Tuesday, September 15th at Aldorf Hospice, Hiawatha, Iowa, after a two-year battle with lymphoma. Please join us for a celebration of Brian's life at Faith Bible Church, 1846 Street Northeast, Cedar Rapids, at 11 a.m. on Friday, September 25th. A luncheon at the church will follow the service. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established to provide support for his daughters. Robert W. Struck, known as Bob, of Van Horn, aged 84, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, May 20th at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Celebration of life will be 2 to 5 p.m. Saturday, September 26th at Turner Hall in Keystone, Iowa. Raymond Merrifield, 78, of Cedar Rapids, passed peacefully September 1st due to congestive heart failure. Services will be held at Cedar Memorial, 4200 First Avenue Northeast, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Mary O'Neill, 79, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on September 15th in Nashville, Tennessee. Visitation is scheduled at 2 p.m. Sunday, September 20th, with service to follow at 3 p.m. at Williamson Funeral Home in Franklin, Tennessee. Interment will be held privately at a later date. Any memorials may be directed to the family. Services in care of Williamson Memorial Funeral Home. C.J. McIntyre Osterhaus of Cedar Rapids was born on October 15, 1948, and died in Omak, Washington on September 6, 2020. Her family would like to acknowledge the entire Thomas McIntyre family and the entire Dennis Olson family for a lifetime of friendship and love. In her memory, please send donations to the Quad City Animal Shelter. James Lester Abbott, of age 73, of Columbus, Ohio, passed away on Thursday, August 13th at his residence in Columbus. Jim grew up in Anamosa, Iowa. A visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, September 26th at Dawson Funeral Services in Olin. Casual attire is appropriate. The family also requests the use of face masks and social distancing guidelines due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A private family burial will take place at Olin Cemetery following the visitation. John Pete, known as Jack, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, September 17th at the Hiawatha Care Center. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m. Tuesday, September 22nd at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Private family services will be held at the funeral home with burial to follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people to be allowed into the visitation at one time. The use of face masks or shields is required. Robert James Thompson, known as Bob, aged 90, passed away peacefully in the early morning hours of September 10th at his daughter's home in Mesa, Arizona. A celebration of life service will be held in the spring of 2021 in Cedar Rapids, with a final resting place at Cedar Memorial. Memorial contributions can be made to Calvin Sinclair United Presbyterian Church in Cedar Rapids, as Bob was a member there for many years. Sarah Ann Tokheim, born December 15, 1941, died on September 13, 2020. She grew up in Cedar Rapids, where she lived for the first 20 years of her life. In late 2019, she discovered she had lung cancer in her right lung. Looking back on her experiences, her latter encounter with cancer would be much more aggressive. Sarah became a resident of the Birdhouse Hospice Home in Iowa City, where she passed away peacefully with her twin sister at her side. Catherine Alexa Winfrey, age 94, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully surrounded by family in Bluff City, Tennessee on September 9th. Linda Laverle Moses of San Francisco, born Linda Laverle Coonfair, died Wednesday, September 16th at her home in San Francisco following a brief battle with cancer. A celebration of life will be held when circumstances allow. Memorial donations can be made to the Women's Building of San Francisco. Laverna Lois Feuerhelm of Marion, aged 88, peacefully passed on Wednesday, September 16th. A private family service will be held. Burial will take place at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Marilyn Mildred Harnish, age 84, of Hiawatha, formerly of Anamosa, passed away Wednesday, September 16th at the Hiawatha Care Center in Hiawatha. In agreement with her wishes, cremation has taken place. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, there will be no public services held at this time. A private graveside service for the family and close friends is being planned at a later date at Coggin Cemetery in Coggin, Iowa. Murdoch Funeral Homes and Cremation Service in Marion is assisting the family with arrangements. Anthony W. Klein, known as Mo, age 56, of Central City, passed away on Monday, September 14th at home surrounded by his family following a courageous battle with lung cancer. In agreement with his wishes, cremation has taken place. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, there will be no public services held at this time. A celebration of Mo's life for family and friends is being planned. Mo's remains will be resting up in the mountains of Colorado at a later date. Marilyn June Anderson of Center Point passed away peacefully in the early morning hours of Saturday, September 5th. The family would like to say a special thank you to Dawn Farmer, Marilyn's niece, for always being there for Marilyn in her final years. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Center Point Fire Department capital campaign for a new station, Critter Crusaders of Cedar Rapids, or the Cedar Valley Humane Society. A celebration of life will be held in the spring of 2021. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point is assisting the family with arrangements. Ronald D. Hamilton, formerly of Grinnell, Iowa, passed away August 4th in Mountain Home, Arkansas. Ron's wish was to be cremated. No services were held. Arthur William Holtkamp, 92, of Harlingen, Texas, passed away Sunday, September 13th at Valley Baptist Medical Center. He was born in West Point, Iowa. Visitation will be from 9 to 10 a.m. at St. Alphonse Catholic Church in Mount Pleasant with the Knights of Columbus Rosary at 9 a.m. A Mass of Christian Burial for Art will be at 10:30 a.m. at St. Alphonse's Catholic Church with the Reverend Connolly as celebrant. Burial with the Catholic Knights will be at St. Alphonse Cemetery in Mount Pleasant. A memorial has been established for the American Cancer Society. Joanne Phillips, 72, of Marshalltown, passed away on Wednesday, September 16th at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A Mass of Christian Burial will be held at St. Francis of Assisi St. Mary Catholic Church on Tuesday, September 22nd at 10:30 a.m., followed by burial at Rose Hill Memorial Garden. A visitation will take place Monday, September 21st from 6 to 8 p.m. at Mitchell Family Funeral Home. For condolences or more information, please call 641-844-1234. Lirata Kelsey Tunks, known as Rita, of Liberty, Mississippi, passed away peacefully at her daughter's home in Liberty on September 7th at the age of 88. She was a native of Center Point, Iowa, and a longtime resident of Wickenburg, Arizona. Memorial will be announced at a later date. Turning to the sports page, Iowa football. Big Ten drops 2020 football schedules. Be safe, be smart. Finale versus Wisconsin could be great, by Mark Morehouse of the Gazette. On Saturday morning, the Big Ten released its third version of the 2020 football schedule. Everyone's eyes seem to be open this time, and now the league has a map to march into the COVID-19 pandemic. It's okay to preface everything with, if this actually happens. When the Big Ten announced its return to play this week following a postponement that lasted 5 weeks, it did so knowing a lot of the slack it had in the first pandemic schedule had been cut out. This is 9 games in 9 weeks, so probably prepare for some COVID-19 disruption. Along those lines, if a team is unable to play due to coronavirus safety concerns, it won't be a forfeit, but instead just won't count as a game. If a team is unable to play all 9 games, there is not yet a plan in place to figure out how to adjust the standings. The Big Ten will have to figure out what happens if one team plays 7 games and another plays 9. Games begin October 24th, plus a 9th game for all 14 Big Ten teams during a newly created Big Ten Champions Week, the weekend of December 19th. Special dates for games weren't announced Saturday. Iowa Sports Information tweeted out that Friday dates will be announced at a later date. The Hawkeyes do face Nebraska on Thanksgiving week and could end up playing on Black Friday, maintaining a relationship that started when the Huskers joined the league in 2011. Let's walk through the Hawkeyes' 2020 schedule. October 24, at Purdue. Each Big Ten team will have 4 games at home and 4 road games. Purdue head coach Jeff Brohm started his run versus Iowa with consecutive victories before Iowa clipped the Boilermakers 26-20 at Kinnick Stadium last season. Purdue had one of the bigger opt-outs of the limbo season. Wide receiver Rondale Moore actually made his decision to leave for the NFL on August 6, 5 days before the league temporarily postponed the season. According to the Lafayette Journal and Courier, Moore hasn't signed with an agent and remains enrolled in school. Brohm said this week that the school will investigate a return for Moore. October 31st, Northwestern. The Wildcats struggled mightily at quarterback last season. Iowa sacked quarterback Aiden Smith 5 times in a 20-0 victory at Evanston, Illinois. It's going to look a lot different this year. Indiana transfer Peyton Ramsey, who passed for 2,454 yards, 13 touchdowns, and 5 interceptions in 2019, should win the job. Head coach Pat Fitzgerald also hired offensive coordinator Mike Bajakian from Boston College, which leaned heavily on running back A.J. Dillon the last few years. November 7th, Michigan State. In early February, Mark D'Antonino surprised college football with an abrupt retirement. He left as the school's winningest coach in 13 seasons. Michigan State hired Mel Tucker, who spent 1 season at Colorado with a 5-7 record. Tucker is a defensive coach. Michigan State had been a defensive powerhouse under D'Antonio. Spartans 2020 will probably look a lot like that. November 14th at Minnesota. The stakes have been raised in the Floyd of Rosedale game. The Gophers were the ranked team last fall at Kinnick Stadium. Hawkeye fans rushed the field after A.J. Epinesa shut the door with a late sack and pressure. Minnesota is considered the biggest threat to Wisconsin going into Big Ten West 2020. Wide receiver Rashad Bateman, who had opted out, has re-enrolled and is hoping for a waiver to play. He was the number 2 wide receiver in the Big Ten last year with 1,219 yards and 11 TDs. November 21st at Penn State. Things have gotten good between these two programs after James Franklin's Nittany Lions delivered a 41-14 blow in 2016. The 3 meetings since have been decided by 1 score. The Hawkeyes haven't beaten Penn State since a 24-3 victory in 2010. Iowa has yet to beat a Franklin coach Penn State team, standing 0-4 going into this year's matchup. This also concludes Iowa's 2020 crossover schedule, with Michigan State being the other game against a Big Ten East Division opponent. November 28th, Nebraska. This could still be a Black Friday matchup. The schedule came out Saturday with November 28th listed, but that could change, and it would make a lot of sense if it did. Iowa and Nebraska picked up some football street cred when the programs lined up with Ohio State on voting for football in 2020. Let's see who spends that wisely. If you have to gauge the heat from Iowa's rivals, you know Nebraska and head coach Scott Frost would love this one. The Gophers haven't held the Pig Trophy for a while either, and probably takes Iowa State's Hate Week mantle this year, not the Cornhuskers. December 5th at Illinois. Whatever creature Han Solo stuffed Luke Skywalker inside to keep from freezing to death in one of those Star Wars, bring one of those to Memorial Stadium. After a 4-game winning streak with victories over Wisconsin and Michigan State, the Fighting Illini become bowl eligible. They promptly fell back to sleep, losing 3 straight, beginning the next week with a 19-10 loss to Iowa. December 12th, Wisconsin. Let's all be safe and smart so we can get to this one. Iowa is falling down the mountain and needs to throw in a spike to stop. It's been 4 straight and 7 of the last 8. Minnesota and Nebraska are chasing Iowa in the West. Don't forget about Northwestern either. Iowa is chasing Wisconsin. Iowa has beaten Ohio State more recently than it's beaten Wisconsin. December 19th, Big Ten Champions Week. The league might really be onto something here. First, how cool does Big Ten Champions Week East versus West sound? And think if this idea carries. Instead of a preset ninth game against blah blah blah, you get a seeded matchup. Yes, this does set up a battle of the worst, but you know you'd watch Illinois-Rutgers before Clemson's demolition of whomever in the ACC. Wait, that could be Notre Dame this year, so we maybe scratch that. And who knows what's going on in the Pac-12. This year, you'd watch Illinois-Rutgers fight for last place in the Big Ten, and it would bring you great joy. For this, probably Michigan for the Hawkeyes, Wisconsin Athletics Director Barry Alvarez, who was in charge of the Big Ten subcommittee for scheduling during the pandemic-shortened season, said the league will try to avoid repeats. Minnesota will already have played Michigan. Briefly, from Mike Kloss in the sports page, Decorah having fun in hair-raising, hair-changing season in Waterloo. At first glance at its high school football team Friday night, you might have thought, wow, there really is a big Norwegian influence in Decorah. The Viking players were almost all blonde. Well, the city is the home of Nordic Fest and the Vesterheim Norwegian American Museum, and wait a minute, Decorah's cheerleaders weren't even close to being all blonde, nor were its fans in the grandstand at Memorial Stadium for the Vikings game against Waterloo East. It turned out to be a lot of dye jobs and one of those team bonding things. Someone could go back in time and pull out the phrase blondes have more fun, but in this case, that was the intention. It was for a team in the oh-so-serious and important game of football to, you know, have fun. We try to loosen each other up a little, said Decorah coach Pat Trowan, who also was a new blonde after a lot of hair coloring was used on his city's male population in the last week. I either won a bet or lost a bet. Trowan wouldn't expand on exactly what the conditions were for him to agree on having a platinum team, saying, "We won't disclose our things here. We might get to see a team again that may want to get us back," or something like that. And this story is accompanied by a picture of about 10 young football players standing in a row in their uniforms with their helmets off, and they do all have bright blonde hair that doesn't look entirely natural on them. Also, from the sports page, West Liberty Lisbon land a Hail Mary to play by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette, Cedar Rapids. There is nothing more appropriate to describe 2020 prep football, nothing even close. West Liberty and Lisbon played a game Friday night at West Liberty that the Comets won 14-12, but the score wasn't the story here. Not at all. Let's start from the beginning. About 1:45 Friday afternoon, Lisbon head coach Phil Whitman was informed by his activities director, Eric Rice, that North Cedar had just called and canceled the team's game Friday night because of a COVID-19 situation. Roughly a half hour earlier, West Liberty AD Adam Loria had walked into Comets head coach Jason Iske's classroom to tell him about a phone call Loria had just received from Tipton, canceling their game at the last minute for the same reason. "It was an oh boy moment," Iske said. "You hear all the stories going around about games getting canceled, but you just don't really expect it to happen to you. My first reaction was, well, can we get a game? I looked at the eyes of a couple of our seniors when I told them we didn't have a game. You could just see it was, are you kidding me?" Whitman said. "When I saw that, that hit me, and I felt like I wanted to try and give them every opportunity I could to play a game." Reese and Loria hopped back on their phones and called around, eventually getting in touch with each other. By roughly 2:15, they had agreed to play at West Liberty in approximately 5 hours. "We're playing at home, so I've got to immediately scramble around and get everything set up on the game field," Iske said. "We had some parents come through, got off work, and came down and painted the field and everything quick. All of my coaches are huddling in my room about 3 or 3:30 just trying to cram some film in to throw together some sort of idea about what we should do." Oh yeah, the game plans. These schools had prepped all week for teams they weren't going to play. One of the comments that was made was that this was like going into a JV game, Whitman said. You just didn't know what you were going to get. Lisbon players were able to watch some video on West Liberty on their bus ride to Muscatine County. "It was nuts. You went from doing nothing to rushing to get things ready to go to West Liberty," Whitman said. "It all worked out. It was a good game. I thought both teams played well and played hard. Was it perfect? Absolutely not. But it was an opportunity to do something for the kids." West Liberty got the winning points midway through the fourth quarter on a 75-yard halfback pass for touchdown from Josiah Galvin to Sam Gingrich. North Tama airs it out. North Tama won its first game of the season Friday night, 29-12, over North Mahaska. Successful passing played a major role. Junior quarterback Gabe Capriva completed 17 of 26 passes for 304 yards and 3 touchdowns. The yardage total is the second highest all-time in a game for NT. Devin McKinley also completed a halfback pass for 60 yards for the Redhawks, with the 364 Capriva-McKinley combined passing yard setting the school's team record for a game. North Tama is 1-3. Insane McShane. Class A No. 9 MFL Marmac shook off a tough one-point loss last week to No. 4 Wapsie Valley by burying Clayton Ridge 34-14 Friday night. Junior Cullen McShane was all over the place, rushing 15 times for 355 yards and 3 touchdowns. The math there tells you his per-carry average was a cool 23.7. McShane also had 8.5 tackles, 6 solos. That included a sack and 2 tackles for loss. For giggles, he returned a kickoff 32 yards and punted 3 times for a 35-yard average. And finally, the Time Machine from the Iowa Today, a look back at people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. The story of a stowaway, adventure-seeking Iowan graduated from college, then went to sea, by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. Thomas Brundage Powell Jr. embarked on a lifelong career as a newspaper publisher in 1938, but not before he spent more than a year as a stowaway. Powell was the son of Mary and Tom Powell Sr., a Cedar Rapids lawyer who served on the Linn County Draft Board before being appointed a Superior Court judge in 1922. The younger Powell graduated in 1927 from the old Cedar Rapids Washington High School and from Coe College in June 1931, after serving as editor of the Coe Cosmos student newspaper his senior year. After graduating from Coe, the younger Powell headed to the West Coast, hoping to get a job on a steamer. 3 months went by with no job, and with his funds dwindling, he hatched a plan to travel for free by stowing away. In San Francisco, Powell saw the SS President Harrison, a cargo ship on the Dollar Line, getting ready to set sail. He nearly abandoned his scheme after seeing how many people were at the dock. While he watched policemen and crew members searching for possible stowaways, he went to the ship's upper deck with his camera, posing as a traveler about to begin a voyage. Another passenger pointed out 2 stowaways being escorted off the ship and suggested Powell take their picture. He did, and then stayed put as the ship slowly made its way out of the harbor. Powell spent the night moving from one spot to another until about 4 a.m. when he went into a washroom to shave. When the boat was well at sea, he revealed himself to an officer on deck who escorted him to the ship's chief officer. The chief officer was angry and immediately reported Powell to the captain while trying to figure out how to transfer Powell to the SS President Grant, also of the Dollar Line, which was headed back to San Francisco. The captain seemed a bit amused someone had eluded his vigilant chief officer. He told the chief officer to take Powell to the boatswain's mate and put him to work until the Grant was sighted. Rough seas made that transfer impossible, so Powell remained aboard until the Harrison docked in Hawaii, then a U.S. territory. An immigration officer questioned Powell and had his luggage inspected, but he wasn't arrested. After a few hours, he was told he was free to go. Powell continued his journey, stowing away on a ship to Shanghai in China, then at war with Japan. He ran into Cedar Rapidian John Mokridge in Shapai, who took him behind the lines within view of Japanese sentries. Powell's next stop was Canton, China. His letters describe the rainy season there as less than livable. He tried to stow away on a ship to Manila, but was arrested and jailed for 3 weeks. Somehow, presumably as a stowaway, he arrived in Manila on June 15, 1932. After that, he headed home to Iowa, although how he got home was never addressed in news stories. In July 1933, Powell graduated from the University of Iowa with a master's degree in journalism and political science and began working for the Hardin County Citizen. A month later, the paper changed hands and Powell stayed on with the Iowa Falls Citizen. He married Geraldine Graves in October 1934 in Coe's Sinclair Memorial Chapel and became city editor of the Citizen in November, moving on to the Fayette County Union and West Union in 1937. 2 years later, Powell partnered with Richard Westerfield of West Union and Westerfield's father, Charles Westerfield of Cedar Rapids, to buy the Anamosa Journal. After the U.S. entered World War II, Powell, having had that experience at sea, enlisted in the Navy in 1943. He served in the South Pacific and was promoted to lieutenant in December 1944. After the war, Powell returned to Iowa and became sole owner of the Anamosa Eureka and the Anamosa Journal in 1952. The Westerfields took over the West Union paper. Powell was asked in a 1958 Gazette interview what he'd say if his son, Thomas Powell III, wanted to replicate his father's journey as a stowaway. "I'd say okay," he said. "I think it's a good experience." Tom Powell III joined his father in co-ownership of the Anamosa papers until 1968 when they sold the businesses. Tom III moved to the Washington, D.C. area, and Tom Jr., the intrepid stowaway, retired. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, September 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.